We all care. So that's one bit of news. And oh, and I didn't send this around, but I did put some. I had something up on the Huffington Post. For those of you who look at HuffPo, on the as those of us who are in the know call it, on the culture page. But it fell off. So it was on for a day, day and a half as the lead feature. And it's basically on the personhood amendment and a little bit of neuroscience. So, you know, now that's not an assignment. Just FYI, I didn't send that to you and want to clutter your mailbox. Let's see, what else? Before we start, and I'm kind of seeing if Paula is going to show up before too long, otherwise we'll just jump to Amy. A couple of things about the executive orders for the President's Commissions. I just wanted to wave my hand at a couple of things about those executive orders, which I asked you to look at. So this is the way that things are done with presidential commissions. Let me just maybe frame the legal side of presidential commissions and how they operate in this country. Presidential commissions are advisory to the president. They don't make policy. They don't make law. There were in the Bush administration, there were something like 300 presidential commissions. They operate under a law that some of the law students may know called the Federal Advisory Committee Act, otherwise known as FACA. And the reason that that's of some significance to us is that FACA requires that all of the meetings and in principle certain kinds of actions of presidential commissions are not only bioethics commissions, but all presidential commissions are public. So that there have to be notices of meetings in the Federal Register. There are transcripts that are published. And there's a certain amount of disagreement about this, but if there are conferences of more than a certain number of members of the commission, those have to be public, announced in the Federal Register, and those have to be in principle public, although people have different interpretations of what that really means. So, federal advisory, that may not seem to you like a big thing, but if you're dealing with sensitive public issues, then having to do virtually all your business in the light of day, it can be very problematic. Not that it shouldn't be problematic. It is supposed to be a democracy after all. But it is certainly a burden on the process of presidential commissions to have to do, even the kind of the negotiating that people do around language in a report, whose views get represented in the report and so forth. All that is in principle public. Now, it's not, in a certain sense, it's not really public entirely because drafts of reports are prepared mostly by staff. But to some extent, they're prepared, depending on the commission, by members of the commission. But to a great extent, the drafting is done by staff, and the drafts are passed around to the members of the commission via email. And that's the reason, partly this is on my mind, is that the next report of the current commission, which is on human research protections, is now circulating, and I've been helping with some of that. An interesting legal question is whether earlier drafts of commission reports could not be accessible if you use the Freedom of Information Act, but I don't know that anybody's ever bothered to do that. The point is that, again, this activity is supposed to be almost all public, and it can be difficult to consider some of these issues in public. Also, under FACA, there has to be a public comment process during the meetings of presidential commissions. And if you go online, you can actually watch the videos of all of the current President's Commission meetings. And I actually would suggest that if you have a few minutes, you might want to just dip in and do that. Some of the public comment periods can get very heated. And in particular, one group that is always active during presidential bioethics commissions are people who believe that their brains are being controlled by the CIA. That sort of the they're being called these days the targeted individuals, the TIs, sometimes known as the Tin Hat people, because on this theory, some of you may know, if you wear something metal on your head, that blocks the signals from the satellites from reading your mind. I'm not making this up.
And they come to the public sessions?
They not only come to the public sessions. If you look at the New York meeting, which was held a few months ago of the commission, if you go to the public comment period, you'll see them giving their public statements. And I actually was approached at, I think it was the second meeting, it was in Washington, by a few of those folks, because they, my other work, as some of you know, is on neuroscience and national security, and some of them had copies of my book to autograph. By the way, unfortunately, although there are many such people, they tend not to buy books. but a few of them did have the book, or they had my previous book, Undue Risk, about the history of human experiments. And so I'm like a big hero to these people. And they're very respectful, even though they know I don't agree with them that this is going on. I actually write about them, right? And the fact that I'm a reasonably legitimate academic who writes about them makes it stand out, or writes about this question, right? So these people are they're more organized now than they were a few years ago because of the web, somehow this particular, I would call it a delusional structure, is mutually reinforcing. And they're easily in contact with each other, to the extent that they trust being on the web, which many of them don't. Their communications are constrained by their paranoia. So it's sort of interesting. But this got to be a real problem at the New York meeting. It got to be pretty heated because they demand, they demanded that Amy Guttman and the members of the commission, stop the CIA, from doing these things, or whatever organization they think is doing it. And I will say, although it's sort of at one level amusing, it's also very sad, because these people are, in many cases, completely preoccupied with this. And in some of them, although many of them are functional, many of them are not. And I could go into more detail about these folks. I've been in touch with them through the normal means, not through ESP. But I actually mentioned to Gabe a few minutes ago that I will be teaching the neuroethics course next fall, and in neuroethics this will come up in various ways. So, little advertisement for that course. Again, this is the kind of thing that's problematic for these federal advisory committees, because they do have to be public. And anything having to do with human experiments obviously attracts a lot of attention from people who believe that they are victimized. And some of them, this is not just clinical trial folks. This is also these kinds of folks. So that's a little background on the context. This is also, by the way, one of the advantages of the National Academy of Sciences committee. Sometimes the National Academy of Sciences will create advisory committees or committees that are created by statute or by executive order, that they pay the National Academies to start a committee. An advantage is the National Academies are specifically excluded from FACA. So that if I'm on a National Academies committee, as I'm on several right now, we're not required to have open meetings. That can be a big advantage. For example, the National Academies did a follow-up to the FBI's report on the powdered and the weaponized anthrax from allegedly from Fort Detrick, and that was very convenient, because that could have been by the National Academies, and some of the information was sensitive. And obviously, if it's an advisory committee that is dealing with classified material, that creates some interesting complications. You have to have meetings that are, maybe compartmentalized and so forth. Whereas National Academies, it's easy. They have a couple of hardened rooms in Washington, where the National Academies building is at 505th. Hardened, I mean, no communications can go in and out. I've been on some of those committees too. So that's just a little context for these advisory committees. Now let me move on, though, to the executive orders. And there's just a couple of things I want to point out about the executive orders of each commission. So to start, let's just start with the President's Council on Bioethics under President Bush. What was unique about the executive order or the charter of the President of the PCB, the President's Council on Bioethics, is specifically that it said that the commission or the council under President Bush would not strive to reach consensus. That it was essentially a kind of a public exemplification of how you could think deeply and richly about these issues. But the goal was not to reach consensus. The goal was a kind of have a kind of public process that exemplified thinking about these values, questions, and bioethics. Now, it should be obvious to you by now why that it's set up that way. The President's Council was set up by people who have had a neoconservative view that academic liberalism has dominated bioethics. That consensus has been used to overwhelm minority points of view, and that too much of bioethics, because it's in the framework of an academic liberal approach, too much of bioethics is legalistic and regulatory, and not deeply philosophical. Right, so not deeply considering problems of personhood and human dignity and so forth. Right. So this was the philosophy behind the way that the executive order 13237 for the President's Council of Bioethics was drafted. And although I don't know, my guess is that Leon Cass had a lot to do with the concept of not reaching for consensus, but rather pursuing what he and his colleagues have called a richer bioethics. By contrast, and by the way, it's very unusual for a presidential advisory committee not to advise the president, which is essentially what the charter says. We're going to discuss, we're going to talk, we're going to think deeply in public, but we're not going to reach a consensus, so we're not going to basically give advice. That's an unusual approach. By contrast, the current president's commission is much more, I use the word technocratic. It considers policy approaches. It says the commission shall pursue its work with the goal of identifying and promoting policies and practices that ensure scientific research, healthcare delivery, and technological innovation are conducted in an ethically responsible manner. So, again, this is much more typical for a Washington, federal government advisory committee that you would actually make recommendations about policies and practices for the federal government and particularly the executive branch. So, maybe a last comment, and then we can open it up for a minute. A question, of course, is always how do certain issues sort of rise to the level of a presidential advisory committee? Right? There are obviously dozens of departments of government, so many that Governor Perry couldn't remember a couple of them. So, there are lots of ways, HHS, Health and Human Services, has hundreds of secretarial, like 200, I thought, something, secretarial advisory committees, including advisory committees on human research protections, on genetics, on vaccine policy. So there are countless committees in the federal government within each cabinet department. So what rises to the level of a presidential advisory committee is a good question. And in principle, it should be something of profound. There's no law about this. I'm just, sort of theorizing here. Generally, it should be something of really profound public importance that crosses departmental lines, so that a single cabinet agency doesn't cover all of the territory that this particular problem that the commission is addressing would capture. Or it's a matter that is so sensitive within that agency, that cabinet department, that it really can't be considered. It would be almost a conflict of interest for the department to consider it. So one example of that is the Challenger spacecraft catastrophe. Remember when it blew up? And a presidential advisory committee was created, and this was the famous moment at which the physicist Richard Feynman stuck one of the O-rings in a glass of ice water and pulled it out, and it snapped. It was maybe that and the Warren Commission after President Kennedy's assassination, which, by the way, comes to mind because it's November 22nd. Some of us actually have that in living memory. Those are probably the two most famous presidential commissions, the one for the Kennedy assassination and the one on the Challenger disaster. So these are supposed to be big issues and issues that would be problematic for a single agency to try to delve into. Any comments, questions on the commission stuff? If we had more time, honestly, I would walk through each of these and we could talk about it for a while, but we got to move on. Celia.
Can this presidential executive order, can they suppress the information that the commission wants to produce?
No. There's no question but that there are conversations with the White House that go on between the commission staff, the executive director usually, and sometimes the chair. But in principle, this is all supposed to be public. Is there territory that the White House would prefer that the commission not get into? Probably. Like everything else, there's a certain amount of negotiation that takes place. And it is at least awkward for the White House, having created a presidential advisory committee, to tell them that there's something they can't do. Not unheard of, but it's, and I'm not going to tell any tales out of school, but it's not something that they would like to do. By the same token, the commissioners are appointed by the president, and they don't really necessarily want to embarrass the president or put the administration in a bad position. So, there are disagreements that surface sometimes. One that I think is pretty well known is that during the Human Radiation Experiments Advisory Committee I worked for 15 years ago, the White House, the executive order for that committee, did not mention anything like compensation or reparations or remedies for people who had been exposed to human radiation experiments without their consent and injured, perhaps. And the commission, in that case, insisted that it was going to address remedies. I was not in on the higher level discussions of that, but I gather that was sort of tense. You can imagine that the Guatemala issue would also raise interesting questions about remedies. But that was not addressed in the report that was published. So,
okay, here's my opportunity. Why wasn't it?
You'd have to. I'm going to be straight with you. You'd really have to ask Amy. Yeah. And the executive director.
The mandate allows for recommendations.
Well, the R word that I have in mind is not recommendations so much as remedies. It allowed for. Now, a complexity here is that since this isn't, this is not on the U.S. citizens, this is in a sovereign country, and there are lawsuits going on, right? So I'll leave it at that. It's complicated. Yeah.
So do they set their own agenda?
Yeah, I mean, commissions can, for the most part, yes and no. So the famous story about the Clinton Commission is that it was promised that it would have like 6 months just to talk. And then within 90 days after Dolly happened, President Clinton said, okay, you have 90 days to make recommendations about cloning. So, what are you going to say? Sorry, Mr. President, you promised. Right. Well, you're not going to say that. You want to serve the president, you want to serve the country. So, there's a certain amount of negotiating that can go on. I mean, Guatemala came out, you know, after the current commission was created. It wasn't created to be the Guatemala Commission, but that's probably what it'll be remembered for. And if something comes up that seems to be appropriate for, you know, the president decides you should do this, then you do it. So, but right now this commission is planning to move on to a report on genomics, and we'll have something to do with neuroscience also next year. And that, as I understand it, is not something that the White House told them they should do. It's something that the commission wants to do. But, you know, who knows? Anything could come up any minute that the White House decides, like Guatemala, which was a surprise, sorry, you really need to do this because there's no other comfortable place to park this problem. Okay, why don't we say we move on to the famous Ms. Birnbaum? Gonna take it from there. So we're gonna we will move on and see if Paula can join us. And now what we're doing is just to remind you, we've dealt with the provocative J. Hughes and transhumanism, and I think you get the general idea of where he's going with that. Now I want to sort of talk about the left response to a techno-progressive like J. Hughes. And Marcy Darnofsky, if you don't know anything about her, is part of an organization, you're going to probably talk about this, so I won't steal Amy's thunder, that is basically, you know, they'd be very much at home in the UK or in Germany. They're basically green progressives. And they have a critique of people like J. Hughes, and frankly also a critique of people like me, who would be considered a kind of bio-progressive and maybe a little too seduced by science, I think, probably on Marcy's view. So, take it away. I will probably also be pretty rough because we do have a few more to get through tonight in terms of time. But
okay. Go. So, Biopolitics, Mythic Science, and Progressive Values is the article from Progress and Bioethics. And...
go. Magic.
The green button, right?
There you go.
Oh, excellent. Okay. So it's written by Marcy Darnofsky, and she's the Associate Executive Director of the Center for Genetics and Society, which is a Berkeley, California-based public affairs organization that works to encourage responsible uses and effective societal governance of reproductive and genetic technologies. And the only other thing I want to mention here is that she definitely identifies herself as a progressive and has worked in progressive movements, and so she starts out with a discussion of the transition from bioethics to biopolitics, and we've talked about this, but I just want to highlight that she really focuses on the transition being one about who's talking about these issues, whereas before it was really just philosophers, physicians, and lawyers talking about the role of biological sciences and technologies in democratic society and human life. Now it is essentially everyone, from political candidates to entrepreneurs, political pundits, fiction writers, everyone. And it's not really clear if this is a good thing or not. It has positives and negatives. So it does expand the purview of democratic governance and broaden the scope of concerns that citizens and civil society organizations examine, but it also takes place in this environment with deep cultural and partisan divides and exacerbates those divides. And this polarized environment is not conducive to thoughtful consideration of the issues a lot of times. And those issues become litmus tests, which resemble exercises in ideological positioning for candidates and other people. So, then Darnofsky focuses a lot on the Bush administration, and she doesn't hold back. And she basically says that the Bush administration bent science policy to its purposes, used science selectively for its political and ideological advantage, and clashed with mainstream scientific opinion. And this basically led progressives and liberals to react by focusing their attention and energies on these issues, and kind of in the process adopt some of the assumptions that conservatives use and that undermines their goals some of the time. So So she basically says that the Bush administration had this uneasy coalition between corporate America and the Christian right, and that all of what the Bush administration did was basically just trying to appease these two groups. And most of the priorities stemming from corporate America explain Bush's objectionable science-related policies. And at the same time, the Bush team was hewing to the preferences of its Christian fundamentalist base, and these, of course, don't always agree with each other, so it's an easy coalition. And this led to this metaphor that we've all heard of, the war on science. And so we have conservatives or Republicans kind of being anti-science in this metaphor, and then the progressives and liberals position themselves as the white knights of science, as she calls them. And she says that this metaphor really doesn't make sense, or is not helpful, because it's not conceptually or politically helpful to decry the Bush administration as having been anti-science, because it's more helpful to examine the way that partisan, ideological, and corporate agendas can make selective use of scientific findings and distort science policy. And Daniel Greenberg says that scientists have an inflated sense of themselves if they think the administration has anything against them in particular as it pursues its goals in ways that disregard their views. So the Bush administration wasn't anti-science, it was just pro-corporate America and pro-Christian right, and if that conflicted with science, that was just kind of a coincidence. And part of what this war on science metaphor did was make progressives create this idea of mythic science. And she says that mythic science is the idea that science is truth, and that it developments in science and technology always are down to the benefit of humanity and never to its shame or sorrow, and that science exists outside of human choices and human efforts, independent of social, cultural, and economic dynamics. And that this leads to kind of an evangelical science, which we've talked about before, how science sometimes appears to be a religion for people. And this is a problem because really there isn't a stark distinction between science and technology anymore. Science is the disinterested confrontation with nature, and technology is the application of the knowledge acquired from that to practical matters. That's really blurred now, and it's really just techno-science with them blended together. And the importance of rejecting the mythic view of science lies in recognizing that techno-science is a social endeavor that is inseparable from social dynamics and enterprises. So the problem is not that science is being politicized, because techno-scientific issues are appropriately political issues since they are social endeavors. But the problem is more so that science needs to be democratized. And she says that the challenge for democratic societies is to protect science from illegitimate partisan interference while working to make science accountable to progressive values and to a democratic polity. So this quotation struck me as a little strange, because she's basically saying we need to protect science from illegitimate partisan interference by making it accountable to one side. So, I don't know. Does anyone have any thoughts about that?
Does it speak for itself, or it's a nice play.
I don't know. I found it kind of
interesting. We'll pick it up. Yeah.
So then Darnofsky says that progressives need to think about several broader political questions in order to form nuanced views on biopolitical questions. And those broader questions have to do with social justice, the public interest, the common good, individual autonomy on the other side, responsible societal regulation, enthusiasm versus caution about science and technology, new innovations, and then democratic deliberation and civil society involvement. So Darnofsky says that bioethicists typically give much more weight to the principle of autonomy than the principle of justice. And this is a problem for progressives, at least, because the progressive values of social justice, the public interest, and the common good provide important guidance to our assessment of new biological technologies. And Sandberger says that as progressives, we must acknowledge the new challenges posed by these new technologies and, when necessary, craft policies to limit their potentially harmful impact. And in order to kind of talk about all of the aspects of their harmful impact, we need to focus more on justice than we do now. And a lot of that comes into play with new divides and discrimination that could be brought about by new biotechnologies. Dornowski says that we need to be conscious of equity and distributive justice and look skeptically at designer medicine that is basically so expensive that only the richest people can access it, and that a real commitment to social justice requires ensuring fair access to reproductive or other biotechnologies and setting limits on biotechnologies that exacerbate existing discrimination and disparities or create new forms of exploitation and inequality. Although she doesn't really get much into the practical side of that. And she says we also need to be on the lookout for biotechnologies that revive discredited ideas about race or that marginalize those with disabilities, kind of alluding to eugenic practices here.
Can you think of any examples, let's go back to your next to that, setting limits. Any examples, not necessarily from you, maybe, but anybody, what do you think Dornowski would have in mind? Biotechnologies that exacerbate existing discrimination and disparities or create new forms of exploitation and inequality? What would be an example of that?
I think when people give, for example, aggressive behavior a genetic component.
Okay.
I say, well, African Americans are aggressive because the genetic makeup that they have.
All right, so ascribing to genetics behavior over a large group of people that could be prejudicial to that, stigmatizing a group. That could be. Okay. What's another? Yeah.
Early tests for a variety of congenital disabilities, or what we now classify as disabilities, allowing selection and termination of pregnancy.
Right. So, you know, better off people get to have healthier babies than people who aren't so well off. In general, that's true. And it's exacerbated by genetic testing, in theory. So, the, you know, the 99% of us, just to think of a number off the top of my head, who, you know, don't have access to fancy new genetics, to screening, but the 1% can go to the fertility clinic and make sure they get a really good embryo. I mean, that's the kind of thing that she has in mind, I think. Anybody else? Another example? Yeah.
I'm starting to see an end to alienation.
Say more about that.
Like the traditional like use of a woman's body, so it's usually targeting the poor that need.
Right, exactly. Marcy and her group were very unhappy with the possibility in California that that you could buy eggs from poor women for embryonic stem cell research. In fact, the Hispanic female advocacy groups got very involved in that issue in California after the $3 billion bond issue passed for embryonic stem cell research. State money should not be used to hyperovulate poor women. So that's a this. She was really on that one. That was a big issue.
How was the state money? How was the state?
The taxpayers of California voted in a referendum to create bonds essentially, you know, for which they were the. But would say with the bondholders, $3 billion worth for over 10 years to support stem cell research in California. And the result of that was that one of the state senators who supported that after it passed was alerted, she herself was Latina, was alerted by Latino organizations that this could be a problem if that money was going to be used to cause hyperovulation in women to get their eggs for stem cell research.
Would it be any women, or were they concerned that it was minority?
Well, any women, but they were particularly concerned about minority women. Yeah. So, Paul, we skipped you, but we'll come back to you, don't worry. Everybody's damp and cold and slow down. So, okay, so those are some examples of what she's talking about.
Can
please advance.
So
whenever she does that, just pretend it's working for her. Just push the button.
Yeah.
For you, humor her.
So Darnofsky then talks about the problem of the increasingly blurred line between academic and corporate research and how there's a lack of effective government regulation and oversight of this research. And because of that, small groups of scientists and private companies end up making decisions about new technologies which affect reproduction and even the whole human genetic future. And so Darnofsky says that we urgently need to develop effective ways to protect the public interest in this new age of corporate biotechnology. And she does acknowledge that some people oppose government regulation, but she basically kind of writes that off as the triumph of the Republican and corporate agenda. And although it has been helped out by dwindling public confidence in governmental capacity and competence, but she basically says that a majority still continues to support government regulation, especially after 2008 when we saw the consequences of regulatory inadequacy. But I'm not sure if I'm satisfied with that answer. I feel like this is kind of a valid concern, and she doesn't give it, you know, kind of the airtime that it deserves. I feel like not only do a lot of people not have much confidence in the government and governmental regulation, but maybe that's something, like a real issue we should address.
Okay.
So I don't know if anyone wants to say anything about that.
We'll come back to that.
So I'm not going to go through this all, but she then describes two examples of existing models of comprehensive biotechnology governance from the UK and Canada that we can possibly learn from. And she says that the UK's Human Fertilization and Embryology Authority that was established in 1991 is basically fairly permissive with regard to what it allows researchers and fertility practitioners to do, but it still sets and enforces thorough rules for their conduct. And it licenses and monitors all research involving human embryos and all facilities offering IVF or storage of eggs, sperm, and embryos, along with other things it does. And that's something that we just don't do now here. And then in Canada, in 2004, they passed the Assisted Human Reproduction Act, which does include more prohibitions, but it was more explicitly motivated by commitments to the well-being and health of women and children and to preventing the commercialization of reproduction. It's coming back to that idea of commodification that we've talked about a lot. And I think it's interesting that commercial surrogacy and gamete retrieval are prohibited, and sex selection except for preventing certain genetic conditions that are sex-linked.
X-linked disorders, yeah.
Yeah, and so I'm not...
Okay.
You can look over the rest.
We got another minute.
So
good. This is good.
Okay. Yeah. So she then talks about the precautionary principle, which is the imperative to treat with caution powerful new technologies that may cause significant harm. And this is basically a way to give public health and the environment higher standing than short-term commercial interests when you're looking at new technologies. And it includes considerations about the common good of present and future generations. So I think this is kind of a way to tilt the scales in favor of justice a little bit more. And on the other side of the spectrum is that techno-utopianism or the mythic science view that she talked about, which she just says is naive and uncritical. And she says that progressives need to basically focus on having optimism about shaping new technologies in the public interest, and that that's the ground on which progressives can base their biopolitical values and find wide political support.
Okay, let's go to the end.
Almost. So I thought this was an interesting issue since we're all studying bioethics. She says that bioethicists may actually inadvertently perpetuate a civil society deficit on issues of human biotechnology because bioethicists are the experts. And that it's actually strange that we have experts in bioethics, because in any other field, like energy, like new forms of energy sources, if there are ethical issues, we go to the experts in those fields. We don't have energy ethicists or ethicists specifically for any other field. So I thought that was kind of interesting food for thought. Although I don't know if I really agree with it, because like that first slide said, almost everyone is talking about these issues now. And it's not just everyone looking to the bioethicist for the answers. So we need robust debate. So she says that even though there are really two groups whose voices are the loudest right now, the biotechnology researchers and companies and the Christian conservatives on the other side, most people actually fall more in the middle. And that most people support human biotechnologies but want them to be developed and used responsibly with appropriate levels of social control and accountability. And that kind of middle ground is where progressives can go. So this is the end. And then she ends with this call to action that progressives should take the lead in promoting and establishing effective regulation and oversight of human biotechnologies, a strong commitment to social justice and the common good in assessing biotech applications, and a precautionary approach that reflects both well-founded public wariness and hopes for a sustainable future. Building on existing policy models, we can develop a biopolitical agenda that will win majority support and protect progressive human future. So I just had a couple questions. Like, are you convinced that progressives can actually develop an agenda that will win majority support? And does the public actually have a strong enough commitment to social justice and the common good? Is that something that most people care about or think about? And do people want more regulation and oversight by the government? And kind of coming back to that question from before, is the progressive agenda less partisan than the conservative agenda that she criticizes?
Good. Thank you. So just to make it clear, what I think is so interesting about the argument of Marcy and her colleagues, they emphasize the justice aspect of a critique of what she calls the sort of mythic view of science. But if you read the neocons, they also have a concern about the myth of science. But theirs is grounded more in concerns about human dignity, right? Whereas the Greens are more concerned about justice and equality. And I was very glad that we got to the precautionary principle, because the precautionary principle is a notion that does tie the Greens together, I would say, internationally as a kind of movement. If you sort of look at the history of the precautionary principle, those of you interested in this, there's a sociologist, a German sociologist named Ulrich Beck, who might have mentioned, I think I mentioned in the book, who wrote a book in the 80s called Risk Society, in which he argues that what distinguishes modernity from every other era is that modernity exports risk. And his case example is the Bhopal disaster in India with a chemical manufacturing plant. So what I think is, sort of my own view of this is that, although Marcy, I think, doesn't quite agree with this, that if you look at the policy implications for both the neocons and the Greens, they're very similar. The arguments are different, right? One group's worried about dignity, the other's worried about justice, but it's still hard to know, how far science should be allowed to go and what the rules are to be. So I'll stop there for the sake of time.
Shall we? Progressives?
Well, I would consider Marcy to be a Green. That is to say, in the spirit of the Green Party in Germany and other Green parties in the rest of Europe, they have adopted the precautionary principle as their central doctrine. And the precautionary principle basically says that if there's any chance that this is going to be a big problem and irreversible, you don't do it. That started out as part of the ecological movement in Germany in the 80s, which included an anti-genetic technologies movement also. It's very early. So, I think although everybody wants to appear that they're in the middle, between corporate America and Christian conservatives, as Amy had her slide, a bioprogressive and certainly a techno-progressive, and we'll give Paul another couple of minutes to finish up on Jay Hughes, would definitely see Marcy and the neocons as drags on progress for different reasons, but for different arguments, but basically the bottom line from a Jay Hughes point of view, I think, is pretty much the same. Little background that I should have mentioned last time. So this book, The Progress in Bioethics Anthology, came out of a little summit meeting of progressives that I had at Center for American Progress. As I think I mentioned the end of last time, I deliberately wanted to get Marcy, Darnofsky, and Jay Hughes in the same room. because I thought that nobody had really noted this tension within progressivism between the sort of, you know, justice and equality oriented folks, so the Greens, and the very techno oriented folks. Now, of course, Jay would argue that a rising tide lifts all boats, that ultimately technological progress and innovation is going to be good for equality, and good for human dignity, also addressing the neocons. Paula, do you want to finish up on anything?
Sure.
Oh, got some? Do we have some slides? Or we can do, you can just...
I'm just going to...
Bring them up? Okay. While you're doing that, the other thing that I think was really important that came out in Amy's presentation is the skepticism about elites, right? The anti-expertise kind of worry that neoconservatives also have. And if you sort of go back to the President's Council on Bioethics charter, there's implicit, I think, in the charter, a concern about elitism. And yet, I would argue, at least, that the notion that this is a group of experts, the President's Council on Bioethics, who will think deeply and model rich thinking about bioethics, is also a kind of elitism. There's more to be said about that, but that's all said at this point. So why don't we go back to the techno-progressives, and then maybe we can raise some more questions. Yeah. So I'm going to give you really like 5 minutes to do this, even though I love my quote.
Yeah, so we're going to kind of finish it up quickly and then show a little bit of the DVD.
Okay.
So, you want that song?
Did you want to talk
about that one?
No, go ahead.
Okay. We just left off
with this image. Yeah.
This is really the image of the paper. In other words, the key word that he uses for techno-progressive is the consistent application of progressive values to technology as it applies to human enhancement. That's my understanding of what a techno-progressive is. But he does allow for a large swath of people coming around from the transhumanist, who's more on the conservative edge, and onto the full techno-progressive, and coming down to the person who's going to have the more economically conservative values. But it's a large gray zone. In other words, you know, you're not fitting into this or this. And
I always thought this was the most bizarre, I don't know what the hell he's talking about here. Anyway, I'm glad you figured it out.
Yeah, I mean, it really actually does make sense.
Okay.
So
I trust you. So why don't we go to the... we're going to see about 2 minutes.
So this is... it's in the book, that purple section.
We got it. So what are we going to watch?
The world that is dealing with. So... I had this piece of the History Channel section on the brain, which deals with neurological enhancement. We've been there, done that. I mean, we've talked.
We don't really need to do that.
I don't think we need to. We've covered it. I mean, the big question I wanted to ask is what has to happen biopolitically for us to get to the point where the internet is downloaded into our head. That's the punchline of the film.
That's what Mike Charost, who I showed you his interview last week, is also interested in. By the way, I've invited Mike to be Colombian speaker next fall, so he'll be here.
So, no, we don't need it. I guess the only other part of this that we didn't cover was, and you know about it, that having to do with the rapid growth of conservative bioethics and the fact that there is an existing infrastructure, that they have money, that they have foundations,
etc. And that is worth pointing out.
Yeah. And that it's just harder for the progressives, because the progressives have that whole wide swath of people who have, you know, there are left bioconservatives, there are libertarians, etc. It's not just one united group. What unites them is progressive values, but they're all over the place. People we know are listed as progressives. Kaplan, Dr. Marino, Glenn McGee. Altichero wrote a paper or a book, I'm not sure which, on endarkenment. That was really interesting. And anyway, the criticism that Hughes has for the progressive activity in bioethics is that they're underfunded, narrowly focused, and lacking unified philosophical framework.
Okay.
Yeah, and we're pretty much done, but I just wanted to point out, so we were discussing this earlier, how there is this, you know, that progressive, technical progressives have difficulty trying to bridge or, you know, cater to both libertarians and left bioconservatives. In great part because of the, you know, the issue of regulation. I mean, left bioconservatives would want some sort of regulation in terms of safety and, you know, kind of control corporate America.
That's the anti-Darnovsky view, right?
So, but then, you know, obviously libertarians would you know, would not be in favor of that. So you know, there is a big difficulty for them, for techno-progressives to try to, you know, bring these two groups together in order to kind of create a progressive, techno-progressive majority.
Okay.
And, yeah.
Okay. Why don't you tell us what is the History Channel?
So this was the
This is part of their series on the brain.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
If we have time at the end, we could show you the last section, but that's pretty much it. Yeah.
And I just wanted to point out one thing. You have to read this a lot to get it, but what I got
you have
from
to be enhanced really.
Yeah, to be enhanced. But I think what Hughes really believes is that, you know, we've struggled with concepts of what it is to be human and what dignity is. I think he really believes that we will be more human, we will be more fully human if, in the techno-progressive stance, we consistently apply progressive values to the technology of enhancement. That's his definition of what it would take.
Okay, thank you. Well done. So, all right, so why don't we press on to get to the commissions? And so I'm not going to say more about the commissions now. We'll just see what happens. You want to start?
Hold up.
Yeah. That's not nice.
Oh, how sweet.
Okay, my name is Marita, and I am presenting on Reflections on Public Bioethics, A View from the Trenches. It's by Leon Arcas. Leon Arcas, he is the chairman of the President's Council on Bioethics from 2001 to 2005. He's a physician, scientist, public intellectual, A.D. Clark Harding Professor at University of Chicago, and Hertog Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Little background, this article was based on a lecture given at the annual American Society of Bioethics and Humanities meeting in Philadelphia, 2004. And the Society had wanted Cass to give his personal reflections about his work on the Council, but Cass was disinclined to do so. He wanted to engage in a serious examination of one of the Council's finished works. And the reason he wanted to do this was he felt that very few people carefully read any of the Council's work but denounced the Council anyway. So he cut a deal with the Society. He would first talk about his about the Council's work, and then the second half of the deal would be a panel discussion about one of the Council's finished works, Beyond Therapy, Biotechnology, and the Pursuit of Happiness. So just a little bit about how the Council came about. By executive order following a vexing election, it was George Bush, Al Gore. A lot of people questioned whether Bush was really supposed to be president. Cass appointed by Bush to head the Council in 2001. At this time, Bush had decided federal funds could not be used for human embryonic stem cell research. This issue received a lot of media attention, and the country was very divided on this issue. Bush is right-wing, Christian, pro-life views. As such, the council was perceived as a group of right-wing Christians looking to ignore scientific facts in the name of religious ideology. So Cass is a neoconservative, and he does oppose embryonic stem cell research and cloning. So Bush announced on television the creation of the council on August 9, 2001. That's where he also announced his decision on the stem cell research. And Cass claims that the council was appointed in the middle of embryo bill. So functions of the council. The function was to undertake fundamental inquiry into the human and moral significance of developments in biomedical and behavior science and technology. And Cass describes this function as deeply philosophical, anthropological, and cultural. He explains that councils do not decide, well, this council does not decide whether something is moral or immoral, or whether a certain technology should be funded or whether it should be banned. They were to restore public ethics, public bioethics, the concerns that gave rise to the field, and they were to enrich public bioethics conversation away from the limited practical approaches that it had been in the previous councils or commissions. So here's a quote from Cass that's important. In brief, our first charge is a mandate to raise questions not only about the best means to certain agreed upon ends, but also about the worthiness of the ends themselves. A mandate to be clear about all of the human goods at stake that we seek to promote or defend. So what this means is the council had to ask questions about where technology is taking us. Examples of those questions would be, how will a generation of those created through biotechnology relate to those that were conceived in a natural way? What does it mean to acquire godlike powers of deciding which genetic defects disqualify one for birth? And how do enhancement technologies distort the character of human activity or change the way we live together? The additional functions of the council were to explore ethical and policy questions related to developments in biomedical and behavior science and technology, and to provide a forum for a national discussion of bioethical issues. Also, to facilitate greater understanding of bioethical issues and to explore possibilities for useful international collaboration on bioethical issues. Another quote from Cass about these functions. We are to probe philosophically, advise politically, and teach publicly. Each a very tall order, together perhaps impossible. So it's very poetic.
Yeah.
The council's approach. The scope is as broad as our functions are wide. So the council dealt with ethical issues related to specific technological activities like embryo stem cell research, assisted reproduction, cloning, but also dealt with broader ethical and social issues not tied to a specific technology, such as questions regarding protection of human subjects in research, appropriate uses of biomedical technology, and the consequences of limiting scientific research. So Cass claims that the council was free to set their own agenda, their own priorities. There was no White House manipulation. And the president receives the reports the first day they were made public as a courtesy, and that all their meetings are public.
Okay. So as stated previously, there are a lot of opponents to this council when it first came about in 2001, because the council was appointed by Bush, it was perceived as right-wing, a group of right-wing fundamentalists who were looking to impose pro-life views on the nation and ignoring scientific facts in the name of religious ideology. There was even at the time, after the August 2001 televised address by Bush, there was a reporter that compared the council to the Taliban, even before the council had even initially met. This was like 3 months prior to their first meeting. Most opponents assume the council was against embryonic stem cells right from the start. Okay, so Cass identifies, makes a point of saying, discussing the heterogeneity of the council itself. He states, by training we are scientists and physicians, lawyers and social scientists, humanists and theologians. By political leaning we are liberals and conservatives, Republicans, Democrats and independents. And by religion we are Protestants, Catholics, Jews, and perhaps some who are none of the above. Although we are a council on bioethics, we are not a council of bioethicists.
Notice the expertise issue again, right? Not experts.
He also notes that there were no political or ideological screenings for appointment to the council. And he states again, this council is the most intellectually diverse national bioethics commission in recent history when it comes to embryonic stem cell research, and I would submit when it comes to most other things. He makes a couple arguments later in his piece. He states that people should not see bioethics as merely the embryonic stem cell research debate. He says, and I quote, to see all of bioethics through embryonic eyes is to miss much that matters and to distort much of great importance. So he notes that there are many other issues worthy of attention, but it just so happens that this one seems to take precedent. He also argues that it's wrong to presume that people who hold the same views on embryonic stem cell research are intellectual clones of each other, and it's wrong to presume that those who disagree on the embryonic stem cell question don't share the same thoughts and meaning thoughts about the meaning of biomedical progress. So he identifies four main aspirations of the council itself. First is they aspire to, as he says, a richer bioethics, which basically means debating the ends as well as the means of the issues. And that they're self-consciously committed to articulating full range of human goods that we are each to promote and defend. The second aspiration of the council is to address the president on political issues in ordinary terms of public discourse. Third aspiration is comprehensive airing of the issues, making the best case for both in favor and against the proposed action. And then finally, to model reasoned and respectful discourse to increase public understanding of the issues. A few of Cass's personal goals were to provide a forum for national discussion of bioethical issues, facilitate a greater understanding of bioethical issues, and challenge the bioethics community to reflect on the soundness of its intellectual and political assumptions. So some observations and questions we came up with. So Cass discusses the council's diversity, but it should be noted that most of them were academics on the council that were considered experts in their respective fields. So we had a couple questions. Did you consider this to be a diverse council? And was the composition of the council itself ideal?
We can go through it.
Okay, I'll go
leave the slide up.
Sure,
we'll go through. Those are good questions.
Cass also states that the council and its link to the stem cell question was given enormous visibility when Bush heralded the council's creation during the nationally televised address, announcing his decision on the funding of stem cell research. So we asked, did the council use this visibility to facilitate a greater understanding of the bioethical issues? And then also, did the polarized political climate on the stem cell funding issue overshadow Cass's goal to facilitate greater understanding of the issues? And finally, more broadly, do we need presidential bioethics committees? Why or why not?
Any questions for?
Well, I asked, when I was doing my presentation, I asked the guy I spoke with who was on the PCB. So that same question.
Remind us who that was.
This is Hurlbutt, Dr. Bill Hurlbutt. I asked him that same question about, because we had the same critique in my paper, was it really as diverse as you guys claimed? He insisted yes, but I didn't get that impression. I felt like it was a defensive posture. Mm-hmm.
I think a couple people have written papers on how the Cass was accused of stacking the council, picking other people with his views, even though, again, throughout this paper, he talks about how diverse they are. But, also, just to say that they were all diverse intellectually, just because they're from different academic backgrounds, you're still MDs, PhDs.
You're an elite group.
You're an elite, yeah, exactly.
There was also one representative, or one group that was not represented on the council, which I thought was quite interesting, and was represented, and this is a difference in ideologies about what these commissions should be like. And there was one of these people I have in my mind on the Radiation Experiments Advisory Committee under Clinton, on Clinton's Bioethics Commission, and on the current commission. But there was no person in this category on the President's Council on Bioethics. What am I thinking of?
A patient.
Yeah. A patient or advocacy group kind of person. Or a lay person. Right? So right now, for example, Lani Ali, who is Muhammad Ali's wife, is on the President's Bioethics Commission. But there was no patient advocate sort of person on the President's Council on Bioethics. Now, you know, does that detract from the view that they were not elites or that they were not experts? It's a question. There is a tradition. I don't know how many of you sort of know about the University of Chicago has a kind of political philosophy tradition. And I think I've mentioned this, that goes back to a philosopher named Leo Strauss, who saw the history of Western politics as really a history of elites. And this was in a kind of an in-crowd. And this was a positive thing for Strauss. And, that there are certain groups that can model deep thinking about tough questions. Strauss was a big Platonist, and he basically had a notion that these elites were kind of the natural intellectual aristocracy. And I have to say, I kind of had the feeling, the way that the President's Council was set up, that this was another version of Plato's Symposium. You know, you got the smartest people in the room talk about it in public, presumably not getting drunk, they were, or seducing each other the way they were in the symposium, but modeling a richer bioethics for the public. But Leon's protestations to the contrary notwithstanding, an elite group, I think, in many ways. But we can come back to this. Yeah.
So I understand that they're appointed by the president. I read that same thing about past academic, but I think the president appoints all of them.
Yes.
So he would have, if the deck was
stacked. Technically, it's the president who stacked the deck, if it was stacked.
But the scientist who was on the first... right. Term
Blackburn,
who took a divergent, right. It was very interesting because it set up purportedly as a consensus. It didn't have to be consensus, but the scientist who took a very divergent view on embryo stellar research, Elizabeth Blackburn, was not reappointed the next term, and she took the position that was because of her views. So,
and she got a Nobel Prize, by the way.
She won a Nobel Prize
for her stem cell work.
And her work actually looked at how, my understanding is, how origins of primitive life started. So they go back to the very beginning. That's my understanding of some of that research. So she was not reappointed. So query if it was so.
Nor was another theologian than Bill May.
And he was also.
Who is considered a moderate theologian, was not reappointed. Now, I'm not going to tell any tales out of school. One view of this in public was, well, I will actually. recorded. One view of when this of what happened was, of course, that they were not reappointed because they were difficult, obstreperous, not towing the party line. However, the backstory on each of them was, in May's case, that he told Leon in advance when he was appointed, "I'm going to be 75. I'm going to retire from SMU and go to Charlottesville. And when I'm 75, you can reappoint me or not, it's up to you." The story on Blackburn that I've heard, which is really entre nous, is that they felt she wasn't a contributor, that she wasn't showing up to meetings, that she wasn't pulling her weight on the council. Now, I guess it's a matter of historical record whether she actually attended meetings or not, so we can find that out. But frankly, the folks who staffed the council, who were my neoconservative, they sometimes talk to me still, they say it wasn't a matter of politics. She just wasn't, wasn't pulling her weight. However, there's no question that publicly it looked really bad. It looked really bad not to reappoint May. And the senior staff of the council actually agreed with that in retrospect. That it looked bad. They should have just reappointed him and avoided the bad PR. But the way it looked was that the deck was being stacked in the reappointment process because they were appointed for like 2-year terms or 3-year terms or something. So, anyway, that's the little gossip, which is, of course, the most interesting part of life.
So if the deck was not stacked, why didn't more of these other people So to say, hey, I'm the person that's not stacking the deck.
Well, the one person who was definitely on the left was Mike Sandel, who I talk about this in the book. You know, Mike is a professor at the Kennedy School of Political Philosophy. He's got this big book on justice and so forth. He's a lefty, but he's a communitarian lefty. Right? So, in other words, he's concerned about the effects of ethical principles from the point of view of communities, not from a kind of autonomy-based point of view. Right? And that autonomy is the first among bioethical principles, is more identified with the left, with the academic left, people like me, people like Art Kaplan. Right? So Sandel was an interesting, if you wanted to choose the most prominent academic liberal who was not in the standard model of the academic liberal who emphasizes, you know, individualism and autonomy, you couldn't have done better than by choosing Sandel. Who was very concerned about the effects of science on communities. But he's a pro-science guy, but nonetheless, he's not part of the... He isn't seen, I think, as part of the establishment liberal view. Sandel, for example, was also an early critic of John Rawls. For those of you who know a theory of justice, Rawls, who's a social contract theorist, right? Sandel, when he was younger, was a big critic of Rawls, who thought that Rawls' theory of justice didn't take into account real communities, real moral values, real value traditions, that it's an abstraction, this idea of being behind the veil of ignorance. Remember that, some of you? So, anyway. So Sandel was a primary case example for Leon of why they were not a party line council. And by the way, so I want you to keep standing there. If you have anything to add, feel free. Any more questions before I will say a couple of things about the gossip on this. Yeah.
I mean, I understand that we want to, I guess, strive to have balanced committees and, you know, government that, you know, looks at different views, but is there any reason why it should surprise us that this would happen?
Right. I mean, presidents get to, you know, I always said this, even though I had lots of disagreements with them, presidents get to decide who their advisors are. You know, I mean, that's what they get to do. So elections have consequences, and they get to decide who their advisors are. So what are we complaining about? Yeah.
It's not a surprise, but they claim to have been different. There were claims opposite. We don't need to have consensus. So it was set up with the veil that it would be more than just...
And one of the critiques... So
but yes, everybody stacks the way they want, but they purported to be something, I think, other than what they were.
Well, whether that's true or not, I'm trying to maintain my objectivity here. One of the things that was said about the Clinton Commission, the NBAC, was that there was nobody on the Clinton Commission who was obviously pro-life. Mm-hmm. Right? Now, I have to say, the pro-life, pro-choice issues did not come up in the NBAC. Right, in fairness to the Clinton Commission. So not having somebody who was pro-life, and by the way, I don't know that there really wasn't, but maybe there wasn't, didn't really make a difference in terms of the way that the Clinton Commission had to do its work. I do have a couple of other gossipy things for you, and maybe one or two actually intellectual things to say about this. And any more questions for them? We can leave those questions up there. Good. Thank you.
Thanks.
Very good. So... Marita, this is back to the gossip, started by talking about the American Center for Bioethics and Humanities panel back in, so this is scary. Was that 04?
Yeah, 2004.
Okay. So the backstory on that is that I was then the president of the ASBH, and so I got to have my panel. Somebody went to the ASBH this last time? So the president gets to have a session. So I got to have a session. So I decided, you know, good moderate that I am, that we would have a session on the President's Council, and we would have two people who represented a more conservative view and two people who represented a more lefty view. And so the people on the panel were, and this is so sad, this is 2004 from 2011, there's no video of this session, and I'm really upset about that. Today that would never happen. You know, everybody would be up there with their iPhones, you know, if nothing else. But there were 500 people in the room. When the program was published, I got a couple of nasty emails from members protesting. that nobody like Leon Cass should be permitted to speak at the ASBH because he was, I don't know, anti-science or whatever. And I thought that was really amazing. And I won't say who that is, but I mean, you know, it's a colleague in another medical school. I thought that was really sort of amazing because, I mean, he is the president's advisor in 2004 on bioethics, and he wasn't welcome at a meeting of National Meeting of Bioethicists. I didn't get that. So it was quite intense. There must have been 500 people there. A couple of people, this person included, got up and turned their backs when Leon got up to speak. Silent protest. There were at least one or two signs. So the members of the panel were Leon, Frank Fukuyama, who is the political scientist, political philosopher, has got a new book out. He's the guy who wrote the book about the end of history. This is how Frank got to be hot stuff. He wrote a book called The Last Man, and it's kind of a Nietzschean thing about the end of history back in the early 90s. He's got a new book out. And Frank was identified as a neoconservative more or less in those days, though he's since pretty much repudiated neoconservatism. And Laurie Zoloth, who is the professor of Jewish studies and bioethics at Northwestern, and a man named Eric Jungst, who you may not know about, but is one of the top several people on ethics and genetics, and he teaches at UNC Chapel Hill. A very mild-mannered person, which was pretty funny, because here's... Now, I think when Frank Fukuyama, I walked them into the room, and when they saw 500 people in the room, I think Frank didn't know what he was walking into, really, because he's not a bioethics person. His eyes got wide, I can tell you. So, my God, what is this? Plus, you got some people protesting at the back of the room, right? So that's the backstory of that event, which I'm really sorry is not on video. And so the most intense moment was after Leon spoke and gave the summary that was nicely summarized, his interpretation of the council being ideologically diverse and so forth. And then Laurie got up, and if you've never seen Laurie speak, her stuff's on YouTube. She is a rip-roaring rhetorician. And as a lefty theologian, she totally went after the Leon and the sort of neoconservative bioethics on kindness to strangers, that the people who cannot afford to have sound good medicine, that we need to do, this is what in Jewish theology is called tikkun olam, the commandment to heal the world in Hebrew, right? And so she gives this rip roaring talk about the obligation to do science and to do embryo research, to save people's lives and to advance science, and we were strangers in Egypt, and the whole Jewish theological thing, right? Really, she's a very good speaker, and Leon had an opportunity to respond, and he was really upset. Leon is a guy who does not. He's a very sweet man. He likes to take tough positions, but he really doesn't like to fight, and that's the only way I can put it. And he really was shocked by the whole scene and by the way that Laurie went after him. Now realize, more gossip, backstory, of course, Leon is Jewish and rather observant, right? And so here's a neoconservative Jewish guy with this, rip-roaring female Jewish theologian who, goes for the jugular. And Leon, as I said, doesn't like to fight. And by the end of his response to her, you couldn't hear it. I mean, something happens to a lot of people when they get upset. His voice, his throat constricted, and he was so aggrieved and upset that by the end of the 3 or 4 minutes he had to respond, there were people in the front row who couldn't hear him, and I could barely hear him, and I was up on stage on the panel. And he did say something. He said, speaking of kindness to strangers, what's this about, right? Okay, so that's a little bit of the backstory of that session, which I'm so sorry, is not immortalized on video. One thing I do want to say about, I think it was, in the Talibanization of the bioethics advice and stuff, that did happen. People said those things. But as I emphasize it, and I think I've said to you before, in fairness, the neocons are not Christian conservatives, necessarily. Right? I mean, you think of Leon, Charles Krauthammer. I think Leon and Krauthammer were considered to be the big voices of neoconservative philosophy. on the commission, and both Jewish. And I think if you read around in what the neoconservative bioethicists have to say about these things, they'll say that traditional values are very important for society. It doesn't mean we buy them, personally. But this is, again, a classical conservative view about how important it is to have moral tradition. And that for society requires deep moral values for stability, because society is very fragile. This is going back to Edmund Burke in the late 18th century. Society is very fragile. And so you may regard this as elitism, but basically what some of these folks are saying is we don't necessarily adopt these particular theological views. We're not Christians necessarily, but we think that moral traditions are very important to keep society stable and in order to ensure respect for persons, for human dignity. The complex relationship, in my view, between socially conservative Jews who identify on many issues more with Catholicism than with Judaism. So I think I mentioned in the book Eric Cohen, the former editor of the New Atlantis, who is a protege of Leon's, said in print, he's sorry the rabbis don't listen more to the priests with respect to the beginning of human life. Very interesting. So these things are going on multiple levels, right? These controversies. I'm going to stop there.
What's the American Enterprise Institute?
So the American Enterprise Institute is the oldest of the conservative, generally Republican-oriented think tanks in Washington, AEI. AEI has produced many important scholars, includes many important scholars on its list. For example, the former UN ambassador, Gene Kirkpatrick, was an AEI fellow. If you go to the reception area at AEI in Washington, this is in contrast, I have to say, to the Center for American Progress, which I love, but because I'm a fellow there, but nonetheless, behind the AEI reception desk is all the books that the fellows have written. Behind the American Progress reception desk is our three big TV monitors, right? Always tuned to C-SPAN and MSNBC or CNN, not Fox, well, sometimes. That's the American. Now the AEI is sort of the somewhat more moderate conservative approach. The Heritage Foundation is the more aggressive, I would say, and that was the model, for the Center for American Progress. On the left, Heritage Foundation, a much more conservative, values-oriented organization. And then there's also an organization which you can read about called the Ethics and Public Policy Center, which is quite small, but they are a conservative ethics think tank, the EPPC. So as was pointed out, you do have these, the framework of conservative tanks thinking about certain kinds of ethical issues and moral issues in society, much more than you have on the left, for the most part. The left tanks tend to focus more on reproductive choice kinds of issues. The right tanks tend to focus more on preserving respect for human dignity and for, kind of more, in many ways, a more continental approach to philosophical questions. So, that's the AEI. And you can, in the wonderful world of the web, you can go online and read about the AEI. Anybody else? These are good questions. Do we need presidential bioethics commissions? Let's hold on to that one. As Leon said, they showed up in Embryoville. Once the president made this speech and then announced he was going to create a president's commission on bioethics, they were sucked into the maelstrom of the stem cell research issue. And I'll just tell you one other little backstory. I was appointed, I think I've mentioned this, to co-chair this National Academies Committee on Guidelines for Doing Human Embryonic Stem Cell Research. And this was at 04 and 05. At one point, Leon called me while we were drafting our final report.
He hasn't talked to me since, but he called me. And this was after the famous panel, actually. All I remember, he says, Jonathan, and he knew we were going to prepare this report on guidelines for doing embryonic stem cell research, and he said, Jonathan, I think you're a man with no axe to grind. And I said, yeah, that's the way I like to think of myself, you know. And he proceeded to, you know, urge me to be very prudent in the recommendations we made about stem cell biology and the ethics of stem cell research. So I thought it was kind of interesting, you know, that he reached out to me, and that was fine. He really believed that he could, you know, maybe, you know, move the National Academy's process in a certain direction, which he failed to do. And when our report came out, his only comment to the press was, well, you can put a group of people together who will agree on pretty much anything. Right? Attack on moral consensus. But also, you could have said the same thing about the council, but he would have said, as was pointed out, no, we were actually ideologically diverse. Unlike Moreno and the National Academy guys, who were all scientists and one ethicist. And Maltacero was also an advisor on that one. Yeah?
Would it be really an embryoville when the president already makes his conclusion? And then it's a very odd thing. Here's my conclusion on this hugely major bioethical issue. And by the way, I'm creating a bioethic council today.
Yeah.
It was in the same speech, I think.
Yeah, it was. And you could have said that he already, you know, established his policy. Mm-hmm. There was no going back.
What was to debate?
Right. There was really nothing to debate about that. You know, that was done from the point of view of the administration. On the other hand, the National Academies panel, all of us who agreed to be on that panel, clearly we had to believe that under some conditions or other, embryonic stem cell research was ethical. Now, we didn't decide in advance what those conditions were, and you can read that, God forbid, you can read that that report too. But for example, we prohibited paying for cell lines, right? No payment for embryos, and we prohibited, as many of you know, we already talked about this, paying for eggs, which really continues to get me in hot water with the scientific community. But Leon, of course, and you know the neoconservative view would be, well, that's nice, but we shouldn't be destroying human embryos for science either. Yeah.
Did anyone in specific request that study for the National Academy of Sciences?
That's a very good question. So most of the that's an excellent question. You got to ask that. So most of the work that's done by the National Academies, most of the reports are done at the request of Congress or the executive branch, and they are paid for by your tax dollars, either via legislation from Congress or by a request, an arrangement with the executive branch. The FBI anthrax investigation, for example, are the Academy's, you know, review of how they did forensically. That was executive branch. Congress pays for lots of National Academy studies. The National Academy's report on embryonic stem cell guidelines that came out in March of 2005 was not paid for by federal funds, and it was not requested by either President Bush, for obvious reasons, or by Congress. And this, I don't know the underside of this, but the National Academies generally do not like to get into heated political questions. So the three presidents must have talked about this a lot before they agreed to do this. And the presidents were at National Academy of Sciences, National Academy of Engineering, and the Institute of Medicine president. So they all had to agree before this was done. Pass the pineapple, would you? Because I'm getting a little hungry. How was it paid for? It was paid for by two foundations and by some money that the National Academies had hanging around. That's how that was paid for. You don't get paid when you're on these things. It was to fly people in to give them dinner, basically, in a hotel room. So we met six or eight times over a course of a year. But yes, that's a good question. That was not requested by government. And, you know, you could see that there was this inherent tension between what the National Academies were doing and what the President's Council of Bioethics was doing. And it was done, you know, I think the presidents decided to do it, the presidents of the academies, because there was money, as you know, private money and state money, supporting embryonic stem cell research, but without any guidance about issues like how could you pay for stem cells, stem cell lines, could you pay for embryos, you know, could you put human neural stem cells into mice, you know, the stuff we've talked about. None of that, there was no guidance from the federal government about that. So the Academy's president decided they needed to have a committee that would get down to into the weeds on those kinds of questions. And in fact, I will just say that our recommendations were instantly adopted. It's so interesting the way this happened politically, speaking of biopolitics. You know, the morning that we released our recommendations, March of 2005, and by the way, we spent Monday on Capitol Hill talking to legislative staff to tell them what we were doing, who were very happy, by the way, because they were worried the scientific community was kind of going to go crazy with embryonic stem cells and put the liberal members of Congress in a tough position. So they were very happy with the National Academies doing this. So we spent a day on Capitol Hill talking to staff. Tuesday morning, there was a press conference. We released our report. And you can find this stuff on the web. And that morning, lots of science organizations said, this is a great report. We endorse this. So the scientific community really lined up with the National Academies, not surprisingly, to endorse these recommendations, and seen in contrast to what the President's Council was doing, right? Which was all about you know, human dignity and worries about enhancement and where is science taking us and so forth. So, yeah.
Another anecdote. I ended up with David Frum, speechwriter for Bush, having a cup of coffee together at one point, and he told me by accident. And he actually had a very interesting take on the Bush embryo talk. He said that within the White House, that was viewed as sort of a declaration of independence from the organized religious right.
Interesting.
That they viewed that as a real compromise.
Right.
And they viewed that as Bush very early in his presidency sort of saying, hey, look, I'm into this stuff. I believe the
science.
I believe the religious stuff, but yeah. I'm not going to stand in the way of science. And so we're going to have to find a way to live together with the scientists. And it wasn't taken that way by the left. But
that's right.
From their perspective, that's what they were crafting.
Absolutely. I'm absolutely convinced that that's right. They thought that it was splitting the difference. You know, you could have a... They were told that there were 60 or 70 embryonic stem cell lines around the world that people could work on. That's what they were told. Turned out to be less than 24, right? So that's absolutely right. They thought that this was a meaningful compromise, that he was declaring independent. The religious right didn't want him to allow any. The scientists were afraid he wouldn't allow any. And actually, if you go back and look at the initial reaction from some of the top scientists, they're saying, phew, that was close. You know, that's great. He's leaving the door partly open. And I think I mentioned before, the assumption was that gradually the administration would liberalize on this issue and would allow more and more embryonic stem cell research, which they didn't do ultimately. But that was the assumption that many scientists had. So yeah, I think that what Frum says is I'm sure, correct. Yeah. But they were definitely really taken aback that gradually this became such a problem. And, you know, the transition from Leon as chair to Ed Pellegrino, that was significant, you know, because there was no longer that sense of activism on these issues when Leon left the chair. Okay, I'm going to stop there. So why don't we now move to who's next? We got next, Shelley. Okay, so now we'll start talking about these infamous commissions. Is there pineapple in there? Or is it just,
where is pineapple?
There is pineapple. All right. I want me. I was there. Good.
Oh, thank you.
But you want me.
You're going to put up the...
We got a little techno help from the techno...
Yeah,
devices.
They're going to do it.
All right.
Oh, I'm going to be in your way if I can.
Okay. And then at the end, don't let me forget, I want to say one word about Will Salatin, who's going to be our terrific speaker next week.
But, one more presentation.
Sorry?
Is one of the presentation after me.
There's, who else is, who's left?
Anita.
Celia. Celia and, oh yeah, guys, you guys. You guys are going to probably be the first hour of the last class, so.
Can I do it on the exam?
No. You know, you're really on me about the whole doing it on the exam. You know, it's fine. It's going to be fun.
Okay.
You're ready.
So I'm going to be talking about, there were supposed to be two people, but I think the...
Maybe I'll switch you to the baby.
Okay. So I'm reviewing The Nation's Conscience, Assessing Bioethics Commissions as Public Forums by Albert Zurr. I hope you are glad I can pronounce it. And Daniel Levin. Okay, you're going to stay awake to keep doing that.
Clicker.
Oh, I have
to. Does the clicker work?
Yeah,
oh, it does work.
You just do a thingy. You help me out. Here you
just
go.
Push the damn button.
Push down my head. Doesn't he look a bit like John Lawrence? Anyway, Albert Zurr is Associate Professor of Political Science in Bowling Green State University in Ohio, PhD at University of North Carolina. And he does research currently on civic engagement and the value of lay participation in areas such as criminal justice and ethics committees. So he's not a bioethicist per se, he's a political scientist. Daniel Levin looks like he's having a lot more fun. He heals behind him. Associate Professor of Political Science at University of Utah. He teaches courses in constitutional law, civil rights and liberties, American political thought. Again, another political scientist. Not a lawyer, but he teaches a lot of these courses.
Right.
He got his MA at University of North Carolina and his PhD at University of Wisconsin-Madison. Okay, I think it's a straightforward message in this article, and basically the authors argue for the importance of, you know, we've been talking about bioethics commissions, of viewing and assessing bioethics commissions through the lens of democratic theory and deliberative democracy. I mean, I think that's the basic thesis of their article. I didn't know you were going to give the intro to the President's Council, but I'll just spend a couple of minutes because I thought it would be important to contextualize this, which you've partially done, which you've mostly
You'll
done.
Do it better.
No, won't do it. So the first presidential commission was what George Washington did when there was this whiskey rebellion. Maybe you learned it in school, did you? He slapped
on... We don't learn history here. Only Canada will learn. Yeah.
You guys learn it. Anyway, he put a 7-cent tax on whiskey, and the farmers in western Pennsylvania were very upset because they had a truck, they turned some of their grain into whiskey, truck it all the way here, they didn't have money for the excise tax, and so they started revolting. And there were all sorts of rebellions over a period of a couple of years. There was tarring and feathering, which I actually looked up, and they actually threw tar on people, and you actually roll them in feathers. And they did do that. So he appointed a commission to advise him as to what to do. I don't know what their advice was, but it lasted for 3 years, so maybe their advice wasn't so good.
It was really a great concern. Bad. People thought there was like a counter-revolution.
It was really bad.
It was really a big problem.
I'll just go briefly through
it. By the way, you know what Thomas Jefferson said about it? I think it was Madison who wrote to him about it. Jefferson said, I think a little rebellion now and then is a good thing. And
3 years.
And it was Madison, who then said to him, please don't say that in public. We don't need another revolution. Yeah.
So as Professor Moreno pointed out, the first commission was developed in the 70s, partially in response to Tuskegee, also the Quinlan case that we've discussed, and I think also in part there was some allocation of scarce resources in hemodialysis, so that was the first commission that was formed. Basically a 37-year history. You said there's been hundreds of commissions. There was some debate in terms of the number of presidential commissions. I don't know how many, but around six. And what I'll talk about scheduling in a second. As you mentioned, they're subject to a piece of federal legislation, which is broader than commissions. It's any federal advisory committee that falls within that, and that allows that public face where there's accountability. It also legislates the term of the commission, which is 2 years, which will expire Thursday, I think, actually, unless they renew it.
Not saying a word about that.
Okay.
It's close.
It's very close.
Timing is close.
The mandate, as we received, were set out in these charters, and I've said letters of transmittal. Sometimes there's a specific memo that the president writes and says, I want you to do a specific thing, and they'll actually set it out in further detail. Usually the members are selected by the president, and current commission, as you know, is chaired by Amy Gutman, and there is a professor from UPenn Law School on it as well, Anita Allen. Okay, I've mentioned Schedule A, and it's at the back of your package, and it's also, you can flip to that. Let's just see. See, lawyers need to do schedules. It just makes you... What I did was, and I'm not going to, no, we don't want, I'm not going to go through it with you, but there's just three pages that sort of summarize the six major presidential commissions. So just when you're bored, when I'm talking in the next few minutes, you can sort of look at it. But you'll see the kinds of mandates, which are very similar, but you'll also look at the composition and the deliverables and reports they did. I found when I was reading this, I wanted to get a sense, they were all blurring together, so yeah. I wanted to get a sense of who did what to whom. So you can just look at it in your packages.
And if you go down, can you get a little bit? Let's see who's on it. The National Commission, which is all human subjects, 74 to 78. Mm-hmm. And then the President's Commission under Carter and then Reagan. And you include the Advisory Committee on Race Experiments, which some people do and some people don't, but I think it should be included.
Yeah, well, Clinton did it through executive orders.
Yeah, the NBAC under Clinton.
Can you do it 100% instead of 125%?
Yeah, then you get the voting in.
Yeah.
Very good. Yeah. And then you get the President's Council and the PCSBI. There was no commission under President George H.W. Bush. Congress tried to start one, but it died of boredom because it was going to really focus on abortion, and they had like three liberal and three pro-life and three pro-choice members of Congress appointed, I think, and they could never even... They appointed an executive director, Bob Cook Deegan, who's at Duke, but they could never agree to meet. So it was a commission. It really died of boredom. It never actually met.
That's right. It didn't.
And then one member from Congress died, and it literally died, and that was the end of that.
Oh, that's that. Okay. So we can go back to the slideshow. Okay, you've already talked about this legislation, and it really is just making things public in a two-year term. What's interesting is the president is obliged to respond to Congress within 1 year. If there's recommendations in a report, within 1 year they're supposed to respond and either adopt those recommendations, put them into some policy, or give a rationale as to why they didn't adopt them.
And actually, that is a good point. The one power that these committees have is this called response-forcing kind of power. My impression is that Amy is very interested in the response forcing power of the commission. So, yeah.
Okay, go to the next one. We're going to skip that one. And just again, what I had said was the overview of the article. They talk about viewing and assessing bioethics commissions through democratic theory and deliberative democracy. And now we'll go into that a little bit. There's supposed to be a little sound bite here, but it's not happening. Okay.
Is it here?
Oh, it's there? Oh, it's a very little cricket.
Can you hear the cricket?
Yeah.
Was the cricket supposed to be going? They quote from Senator Kennedy, who's more talking about the commissions of the 60s, and he's saying it seems as though most presidential commissions are merely so many Jiminy Crickets chirping in the ears of deaf presidents, deaf officials, deaf congressmen, and perhaps the deaf public. They could be the nation's conscience, although our authors want to say in public forum, spurring us on to do what we know ought to be done, showing us the way, strengthening our determination to build a just and peaceful and productive society.
And this is, of course, before the first bioethics commission. Yeah.
This is just on the cusp of the first bioethics commission, but he's talking about commissions in general and presidential commissions and the need for them. Well, the opportunity to really portray the public and the public's conscience to the president.
By the way, Kennedy, with Mondale, who of course ran for president, was Vice President Carter, and Jacob Javits, which is a name that will not ring a bell with most of you, who was a liberal Republican from New York, were very interested in having some kind of commission on medical ethics in the late 60s. And that did not happen until after Tuskegee in 1974. That really pushed it. Anyway.
I just go back for a sec. Want to mention that the soundbite, in deference to our authors, was the sound of a field cricket, one of the populace. Okay, so it wasn't an expert cricket.
Not an expert cricket.
Yeah. So the authors state that democratic theory requires public engagement by commissions, learning how average citizens resolve moral issues in healthcare, that commissions should be monitoring public opinions and addressing public concerns. In terms of deliberative democracy, this is somewhat different than just ordinary democracy. I think the term came up in the 1980s or was coined in the 80s. Mm-hmm. It states it's a form of democracy in which public deliberation is central to legitimate lawmaking, adopts elements of consensus decision-making and majority rule, and it differs from traditional democratic theory in that authentic deliberation, not just voting, is the primary source of a law's legitimacy. He goes on and he coins some of the, or he puts together the critiques that have been made of the emphasis on commissions. And one is the ivory tower critique, where he says members are driven by norms of scholarly integrity, methods better suited to academe than to halls of Congress, that they have to be, you know, faithful to academic niceties, faithful to analyzing issues in an appropriate way, and not to necessarily listening to the people, etc. There's a skeptical critique that the notion that you have a moral expert or you're looking at the composition, the one thing that came out for me when I looked at this schedule of presidential commissions is they really are, they're all experts. The odd, believe it or not, I think Cass might even have had a couple of lay people on it, but by and large, they're all experts. And that this conflicts with the notion that it's each of our daily opinions and lives, it's every person's role to be a moral expert, and we don't just look at the moral experts, it's what the populace at large considers on moral issues. He also puts together an ethnographic critique that bioethics requires a new moral theory, faithful to real-life moral phenomena as to what's happening out there. He sees medicine as actually quite powerful, and things are going on, decisions are being made. So with Karen Ann Quinlan, there was an issue as to parents, does the doctor get to choose, who gets to choose? And that looking at the scope of a bioethics commission, we should look at what's really going on out there. What's the context of the people whose lives we're talking about? He talks about how people generally assess commissions. I'm not following my slide faithfully, see. He talks about looking at things like, were the policies adopted? Were the recommendations influential? Was there a law created that looked at these things? How many times were they cited in journals, etc.? And he says, this really isn't the way one should look at a bioethics commission. One should look at, do they really, and I guess it was Cass was sort of saying he was going to do it, yeah. Do they reflect a national debate? Do they look at the concerns that might not come up if you've got a group of experts sitting in a room? Maybe they don't have the same concerns. He says there's two ways to understand the functions of a commission, and sort of we've been through this, one of expertise, where the experts develop all the solutions, lay them on the public, or agenda setting, where they spark, guide, and ask the populace to come up with ideas and resolutions to some of the issues. He obviously favors the second one. He talks about processes for greater public authority. One of the things I just wanted to say is that the FACA, that legislation, requires that all these committees only be advisory. So according to law, they can't have recommendations, because I think the next article looks at whether or not you can have
the advisory commission.
So here, when you see decisions, read recommendations. So he says the reasons for the recommendations should be public. Recommendations should be based on reasons recognized as valid by the public, including the minority. That we really have to look at what's important to people when we're making these arguments, when we're making recommendations. He wants an ability for the minority to challenge and revise these recommendations, and he thinks they think they need to be formal oversight and regulation to make sure that 1, 2, and 3 happen, that there really is a public presence.
By the way, on that previous slide, the minority ability to challenge and revise, interesting thing to do is to look at some of these reports from presidential commissions, if you're interested in one, and see if there is any dissenting statements. It's very rare. The advisory committee on human radiation experiments allowed Ruth Faden, who was the chair, allowed Jay Katz, who was a law professor, psychiatrist at the Yale Law School, to write an individual, it was called an individual statement. But what, in general, and this sort of goes to the consensus business that Leon's worried about, in general, commission chairs are loath to have a dissent. They'd rather work it out somehow, some coordinated consensus of some kind. Mm-hmm.
So his resolution is for bioethics commissions is to bring the public back in, address public concerns, create forums where there can be public ways of moral decision-making, and to allow for public education. so that the public can make these decisions and ideas. So in terms of the questions I had when I was going through this, and I know we may not have time to talk about them, but is public engagement consensus building a legitimate function of a president's advisory commission? Think about the commission. Like, it's a president's advisory commission. So he or she, there's never been a female president, but she in the future, strikes this commission. I mean, there's some merit in thinking that they do whatever it is useful to provide that advice. But anyway, is it necessarily a legitimate function? No. Are academics even skilled at public engagement? I mean, you take these wonderful scientists, philosophers, political scientists, are they the people that you want to be on the ground and trying to figure out what real people think? Is this maybe not a waste of expert resources? I want scientists to do science. Philosophers to write philosophy. I don't want them necessarily going out and doing the public engagement. So maybe the public engagement's important, which personally I actually think it is. And I am, Ken and I had a discussion about this. Certainly when we're passing laws in Canada, there's always a chance where you would have a public consultation.
And here as well. I mean, you have this comment period and so forth.
Or even in development of policy, one of the things I did was work in policy analysis for 6 years in the Ontario government, and you would structure there to be public engagement. You would actually have, you know, town hall meetings. You would have a series of questions. Right. People would be invited. And before you would even develop the policy options that would go to our cabinet, you would have to have a pulse on where people were at. And they would come up with ideas. The idea was that people on the ground doing some of the things might come up with ideas you never thought about, because if you're not immersed in it, how do you know?
The Commonwealth countries are generally on all fours on that process. Australia does that, and the UK does more of that than we do.
But sometimes it's helpful because you avoid some of the pitfalls that come up later when a law is already in process.
In a way,
that doesn't work.
From a political science point of view, in a parliamentary system, you sort of have to do that, right? Because in a parliamentary system, there are certain kinds of votes that are taken, the government falls. So you want to make sure going into the parliamentary process, if, correct me if I'm wrong, but that the system has a way to absorb the views of a pretty wide swath of folks.
Other questions are, should composition of commissions include members of the public? They seldom do, and by the way, they can't get paid. So.
Right.
By their very structure, they meet during the day.
Yeah.
They meet in Boston here or there. So your average worker
cannot afford to do that.
You're not going to be able to be on a commission where they get no money, and what work is going to let them off? But should they?
That's very true.
Should public engagement, public debate remain in the political arena? What are we doing? Are we going to have another sort of political vehicle where you can't have a proper elaboration of the arguments because it becomes very politicized? If commissions are the forum for deliberative democracy, where's the room for fact finding in education? So in the most recent report of the current commission on Guatemala, it turned out to be a real fact finding thing. What happened here? What memos went on back and forth? I don't know how that marries up with a public vehicle. Although the place for that might be in the recommendations.
Mm-hmm.
Should public engagement be one aspect of the mandate of the commission rather than its exclusive mandate? And just a comment, how can politically appointed members be neutral or objective? And these were all people that are handpicked by a president, and presumably they're handpicked based on their views, some allegiance, because they're good people, but does that by nature of design obviate objectivity?
Good question.
So I don't know.
By the way, in Canada has a National Bioethics Commission that is a standing commission. This goes to the question that several of you have raised tonight. Why should there be in the U.S., they're ad hoc, basically. Every president gets to decide if he or she has one. Arguably, that makes them more political, right? Whereas if it's like something that is, say, Congress and the president appoint a board like the Nuclear Regulatory Commission or something like that, and the memberships go through, 6-year terms, say, does that somewhat remove it from the political aspect? Now, in the U.S., that there's no way in the short or midterm that there's going to be a standing bioethics process in the federal government. It's just not the way we do our politics. But in most of the rest of the world, dozens of countries have standing bioethics agencies or agencies that encumber bioethics decision making. But that's not the way we do it. By the way, another question you could ask is how much do these commissions cost? Because they do cost money. Millions of dollars.
$2 million, I think, is the budget for this year's commission. So one point in a bid, and then they give staff time of the people that are in.
Right. So I know that the Radiation Experiment Advisory Committee was, over an 18-month period, was $5 or $6 million. And that did not count, and this, and by the way, that 1.8 or so doesn't count also. When the Guatemala, when you do your fact-finding, you go to other federal agencies as a presidential commission, and you tell them you need some data, or you need somebody from that agency to come down to your offices to talk to the commission or the commission staff. Right? That's also lost time. So on Guatemala, there were NIH people, there were DOD people who had to respond. And you can't hang up on the executive director of a presidential commission and say, I'm sorry, I can't, I don't have time for you, right, if you're working at another federal agency. I guess you could, but that would not be a wise career move. There wasn't, the GAO, the General Accounting Office, now called the Government Accountability Office, estimated that the Radiation Experiment Advisory Committee, in-person hours, when it went to all of these different federal agencies, like a half a dozen of them, to ask them to go back to their records and see who they've done radiation experiments on since 1945, that it was tens of millions, I don't remember what it was, tens of millions of dollars in effect that are not reflected in the budgets of the commissions themselves. When you, when you have these, have to go out and collect information from the rest of the federal government. So it's real money, quite apart from everything else. So, yeah.
Why is there such a focus on, I kept thinking about like the courts, you can have a dissenting opinion. Why is there such a focus on consensus? Because dissenting opinions are extremely legit, important, and they make you think about things. I don't know why.
Well, the news story, from the point of view of sort of realpolitik, if there's a dissenting opinion, that becomes the news story rather than the report and recommendations of the commission itself. Why? Because that's what people in journalism, no offense to the journalists in the room, look for as they look for the tensions and the conflicts. So a commission chair, you're putting so much work. I can tell you, these people work really hard. You're putting so much work into these reports. You don't want the big story to be that one obstreperous member who didn't agree. You want the story to be, these are our recommendations. This is where the government should go. And also puts the administration in a tough position. Then it doesn't know sort of what to do if that's the story. The story is the dissent. What does the administration do with that report? So, I think that's a reason that people really prefer not to have dissents. Individual statements, for example, back in the Radiation Experiments Advisory Committee, Professor Katz believed that the commission had not adequately grappled with the failure of informed consent over the decades that radiation experiments were being done. And that was his individual statement, which you can read, was all about that. And he said that publicly. He felt he failed to really convince the commissioners that there had been a real failure with respect to informed consent, and that should have been the thrust of the report. So he gave an individual statement to that effect. But yeah, people really try to obey, people try to avoid them if they can.
Do you folks feel the public should be involved? Does anybody have an opinion on that?
And how should we look at it?
It sounds good, but I've been on several boards of community legal services organizations and things like that where there's a statutory mandate to have client representation.
Yeah.
And it's really window dressing. People who are clients of legal services organizations are just not equipped to make budget decisions, things like that. They have no exposure to most of the things that a board has to deal with. And so I think it's very, very inefficient. It takes an awful lot of human resources to have people like that on these boards for very, very little
to educate them, to bring them along.
Beneficial effect.
Yeah.
And I could see the same thing being true in these cases as well. I do think there needs to be public engagement. I just think it's sort of a, it's almost letting a commission off too easily if they say, okay, we have public engagement because we have a public member now.
How would you engage the public?
I don't think that does it. Well, that's
hard.
That's hard. It's hard in our system, I think, much harder than in a parliamentary system,
yes,
for all the reasons that
Professor
Moran has stated.
It's very
hard. But it does, I mean, our discussion really made me think more about this. We used to have in our polity public intellectuals,
right,
whose writings and pronouncements were the subject of water cooler conversation the next day in offices all around the country. And we don't have that anymore. We've lost that in the last 30 years.
Which just reminds me to remind you that next week, Bill Salatin will be here. Will Salatin, who is, a kind of public intellectual, very much a public intellectual, and you might want to go back and look at some of his previous, he had a series of columns in Slate called Human Nature, which he doesn't do anymore. Will followed, the reason I invited him is Will was my speaker. Thanks
okay.
Will was my speaker at the dinner of that summit of bioprogressives or biopolitical Center for American Progress 5 years ago or so. And Will is somebody who's really followed the neoconservative and all the stuff we've been talking about, the neocons and the funny-headed liberals like me, on these science and ethics issues as a journalist. And so he is somebody, but, it's certainly true, and there's a literature on how intellectuals were captured by academia after the Second World War, because, it beats not eating. As academia expanded, people who used to write for little journals and just give talks and, would get honoraria for books, this is before the Second World War, when life was less expensive, those folks are, those folks are pretty much professors now. But you do have people like Will, who's very sharp, and I think you're going to really enjoy him. And so it will be open, of course, it's not just for us, it's also for everybody in the program. And so there'll be a whole lot of people in the room. But I do want you to, think about a question for Will. More about sort of all the biopolitical meanderings and comings and goings than 99.99 and fill in the blanks percent of Americans. And by the way, I think Autumn and Nora will send out an email, or Nora, about dinner with Will.
It's
already full.
Yeah.
Oh shit!
In 10 minutes.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say jump on that, but anyway, too late. Anybody go? Anybody get lucky? Good. Okay. So. That's good. But he'll be around a little bit. You can talk to him and engage him. And I think you'll really enjoy that. And he is the perfect person to be doing a talk for us. So stay dry. Thanks to all our presenters.
Princeton community put bioethics into their curriculum a couple of years ago. That wasn't bad.
No, they should have, obviously. They should be able to be great.
Yeah.
We have one left.
I wonder if they did Bobby George.